Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Sigrid Nunez's first book since The Friend, winner of the National Book Award, looks back to a precarious pre-pandemic world. What Are You Going Through is a story of death and companionship, loneliness and obligation. As she writes, messy life, unfair life, life that must be dealt with. Much of the book centers on the narrator's conversations with the dying friend who has asked, as a final wish, that they vacation together in New England. Nunez explores human connection and the changing nature of relationships in our times, a story about empathy and the unusual ways one person can help another through hardship. Again, the new novel is What Are You Going Through? And it's a great pleasure to welcome Sigrid Nunez to this week's book show. Thank you very much for being with us. What a pleasure.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
What brought you down this particular path of wanting to really look at someone dying and what a friend can do for them?
Well, in many ways, I stumbled on the story in the sense that I have the same method for writing for everything that I've ever written, every book that I've written. I just begin somewhere with something, and then I move on. So it just so happens that it came into my head a couple of summers ago when it was time to start a new book, and I thought, well, about what? What do you want to write about? It came into my head to say, I went to hear a man give a talk. Now, I hadn't really gone to hear a man give a talk. I just made that up. And I started writing, and then I had to say, well, what was he talking about? And where is this first person narrator and so on? And I started pulling things together. So she was in a strange town. Well, what was she doing there? She was visiting a friend who was in the hospital. And then I decided that friend was an old college friend, someone that she had stayed in touch with, but they weren't close at the moment. And that person had cancer and she was under treatment. And so she was visiting her for that. And then I just went on. And then to just carry on with the story, well, what would happen if she would decide, well, I know that I don't have much time. I want that control of choosing my moment of death, but I need someone to help me, not to help me actually do the dying, but just to be with me for a time while I take care of last things. So that's really where it came from. It wasn't premeditated, as it were. I don't premeditate my stories.
And once you have the story, does it come as you're writing it, in the sense that in the first almost roughly half of the book or first third of the book, we meet the woman telling us the story, and there are many different things that she is navigating through and telling us about various people and various situations. And it really isn't until the second half where things rev up and we learn about the relationship between these two people and what ultimately their relationship is going to be as they navigate, as you write, her journey through death.
Yeah, it all came to me while I was writing it. You know, I might at a certain point have an idea about something I might want to put into the book later, so I might make some notes. But basically, it's really something that grows under my hand, as it were. There is always more than one thing going on in a life. And so my narrator has different encounters with different people, and I report on all that. But she's in a certain state of mind. You know, she's paying very close attention to the stories she's hearing from people. And basically what they're talking about when you get down to it is what they're going through. It might in some cases be something fairly minor but very stressful for that person. In other cases, it's the most extreme thing, which is having a terminal illness. So as I say, early on, right at the beginning of the book, one of these people, one of these characters is this person she's visiting in the hospital. And then by about the midpoint of the book, that person takes center stage as the other main character. And then it moves on, it narrows down until it's pretty much just the two of them.
And a lot of meditation at that point on death, on living, on our relationships, and also, it should be said, about writing, Both of the women are writers.
Both of the women are writers. The friend who is ill is not doing any writing, nor does she desire to do any writing at this time in her life. And in fact, the narrator isn't writing much either. They both seem to have come to a point where writing is not going to help us here. In fact, the narrator thinks, oh well, you know, I really should keep a journal. This is a very important time. It will help me to collect my thoughts. In addition, I will have this journal of the last part of my friend's life to share with other people, because other people don't know that these two women have gone off. And it turns out that she's really not able to do that. It seems so like the right thing at the time, and then she just never does it. But they are both professional writers. Yes.
The second woman says at one point in the book, "I've decided I'll write about it only if I discover something new to say about it, which won't happen." Can you ever imagine that for you of not having something to say or not wanting to write about something for those reasons?
Well, when the friend says that, I'll write about it only when I think I have something new to say, she's talking about, you know, that she, writing about it, let's say for publication.
Right.
And in her view, many people have written about dying and death. Much has been said. She doesn't feel that she has anything new to add to that. And she probably doesn't. And I think that I would feel that way too. I'm not saying I wouldn't write about it, because I can't say, but I certainly wouldn't think, oh, I will have some fascinating, wonderful, interesting, new perspective on this that no one else has had. I wouldn't think that would happen.
As you speak and talk about your writing as you go, and when we learn about movies and we learn about books that the narrator has read, are those mirroring experiences that you have had or things that you are thinking about?
Yes, and it's exactly the same way as I was saying before, that, you know, I'll be carrying on. I'll be writing. I'm telling my story. I'm at my desk. I'm writing every day. I come to a certain point, and it will remind me of something that I've read, of some book I've read, some story, some whatever, or something that I've heard, or it will remind me of a movie that I've seen. And then I don't say the words, you know, that reminds me, but basically that's implied, and I'll say, well, this is relevant here, and it's interesting. It's interesting to me, and I hope that it will be interesting to the reader. And of course, it is the way the narrator observes life. It is typical of the narrator, who is a writer and a big reader and a lover of movies, to make these connections between what is happening in real life and the things that have made up her literary and artistic education.
Sigrid Nunez is our guest on this week's book show. The name of the book, What Are You Going Through? Is it significant that there is no question mark on the title?
The title comes from a quote from an essay by Simone Weil, and she does have a question mark at the end. It seemed to me it just wasn't necessary, and there was something about putting the question mark there. It almost felt like it would be like a self-help book or something. I guess partly there's an assumption there. Look, we know you're going through something if you're human. So what are you going through? You know, it's not even a question. It's a statement. Speak. What are you going through? It's not something I weighed. I knew from the beginning. This is a book like The Friend, where I had the title from the very beginning. I knew this is what it was going to be called. I never had any other title that I considered. And from the beginning, I I did not have a question mark. But the title, which I use as an epigraph for part one from Simone Weil, the love of our neighbor in all its fullness simply means being able to say to him, "What are you going through?" Right. Question mark.
Right. You, as I said, you write about a lot about writing in here, and it's throughout the novel. At one point, the narrator says, "I've never liked the genre of women's fiction known as romance, but I am fascinated by stories of women in love, especially when the love is in some way unconventional or especially difficult, hopeless even, or frankly insane." Have you, because you write so much about women in this book and you also write so much about friendship, has that been something that you've wanted to write about specifically?
Which thing?
Writing about stories of women in love.
Oh, yeah. I do share that feeling with my narrator that it would be very interesting to write a book about stories like the story that I give of the relationship between Dora Carrington and Lytton Strachey. And I imagine that the title would be Women in Crazy Love. I mean, it's a bit fanciful, but it is something that I find it very compelling, the subject, you know, getting involved in what appear to be hopeless relationships, that are full of passion and full of interest to me. I do think they make good stories and much more interesting stories than your kind of conventional romance novel story, which follows a formula.
You also write on this subject of, you quote Balanchine, George Balanchine said, "If you put a group of men on stage, you have a group of men. But if you put a group of women on the stage, you have the whole world. If you put a group of women in a book, you have women's fiction to be shunned by almost all male readers and no few female ones as well." It says a lot.
It says a lot. I mean, things are changing, and that's a very good thing. But, you know, in the years that I've been writing, you know, I have always been aware that that people thought of this thing that, you know, if it was something written by a woman, if it was about women, if it was about women's lives, it was this genre called women's fiction. That's one thing. Not just fiction, but women's fiction. And when people, men and women, would hear that something was women's fiction, it was implied that it was lesser fiction. That was simply true. I'm not saying that every individual reader felt that way, but it was certainly something that any woman trying to write and get published was well aware of. And so, you know, there were a lot of women writers who felt very strongly, "Don't call me a woman writer. I'm a writer." Or "Don't refer to my work as women's fiction." That came to my mind when I came to that part in the book.
You use the term a couple of times in the book, which I think is interesting. Of it's usually italicized, but "This is the saddest story I have ever heard." You seem keenly aware of those sad stories.
Yeah, I'm there. I'm quoting, as I so often do, the first sentence of Ford Madox Ford's 1915 novel, The Good Soldier. When Ford Madox Ford wrote that, there was a ton of irony in that sentence, and you have to read the book to understand why. Mm-hmm. And you should read the book. It's a wonderful book. So I'm not being so ironic. There is a place where I quote that, I often remember that line when people are telling me their stories, particularly when they're talking about their relationships with family. Very often how, you know, things aren't working out within a family, you know, what we would call a dysfunctional family. And it always strikes me as extremely hard to hear, extremely, extremely sad, because of course we have this idea that, you know, that family should be a beautiful, wonderful thing that works very well. And so often there's a sad story of sibling rivalry or of some kind of, you know, severe disconnect between generations. And in my book, the reason why that comes up is because the narrator's friend, who has cancer, has had a terrible relationship with her only child, her daughter, which never should have happened, we can say, but it happened from the beginning, and they have not been able to heal.
There's a fascinating scene in the book where at one point the ill woman goes to a support group to talk about this, and we learn a lot about one of the women who is in that group. But I'm interested in your thoughts on just that idea of the support group, and especially the story of the particular woman that you tell us about, but also just of how many things that this dying woman does and goes through that so many who are ill do go through, and yet nothing's really working for her.
Well, that story, that when that woman is given a chance to say in her support group what she's going through, is really an unbearable story in which she talks about her feeling that her husband, she's been married a long time, she has grown children, her marriage started out very happy, but for most of it, it has not been happy at all, but they have stayed together. And her feeling, she picks up on this, she believes, from her husband, that once he learns she's terminal, he's not crushed. He's not jumping up and down. I mean, but he's not crushed. And she feels that he is thinking about his freedom. And he's being incredibly good to her. He's taking excellent care of her. But she is sure that she knows him so well. She is sure that he is not unhappy, that he's going to be a single man soon. And she tells this story, and the people who are listening, I think understandably, I mean, it's very difficult, just one can imagine what it must be like, they decide to go into complete denial mode. And instead of hearing her and believing her, or even discussing it, they basically shut her up by saying, that's impossible. That he doesn't feel that. You're just imagining it. You've got chemo brain. You're upset. I mean, didn't you say he's taking care of you? You know, he's just being so cheerful because he wants to, you know, everybody thinks that's the way to help the patient. You know, I mean, this may be how they honestly feel, but you know, the woman who's actually going through it is deeply pained by that and doesn't try to fight against it. But certainly whatever is going on there, she is not getting what she needs. And my narrator's friend, who decides to attend the group, who's coming to the end of her life, everyone in the group is, excuse me, that's not true. It's not everyone in the group is, but everyone does have cancer. Does have cancer. But she is so appalled at that, the fact that people don't know what to say to her, to that other woman, and that they just, you know, kind of poo-poo it in a way, that she cannot return to the support group. She felt that it was in fact for her, she felt completely unsupported.
And there are many things that she does and notes throughout this that seem, as I said, don't quite work for her, and wonderful observations that she makes and how people react to her. I'm curious of what it is you think about your narrator that makes her want to or say yes to this woman who is looking for help in ending her life.
Well, I think at the very beginning, I mean, she doesn't want to do it. She starts out by being appalled by the request. Then she asks if she could have a little bit of time to think about it. And then she feels that she has to say yes. I can easily imagine being in that situation. The dying woman has asked other people. They have all said no.
Right.
So when she asks this friend, her friend, the narrator, she feels that she has to help her. Somebody has to help her. So she says yes. Then she has her doubts and she expresses those doubts. And her friend says, well, you know what? At this point, I'm going to do it anyway. So if you want me to do it alone, that's what will happen. But I do not have the energy or the time to go down a list of all my friends and acquaintances. Then my narrator agrees. And then she herself experiences all this denial. She's thinking, well, we're going off, you know, but that isn't to say just because she has actually gotten hold of the euthanasia drugs that she's going to take them. Most people who do get euthanasia drugs, in fact, do not end up taking them. So she thinks, okay, so I've said yes, but I don't know that she's really going to do it. So, you know, she's in that stage where she's just thinking, well, maybe this won't even happen. But finally, she does think that the reason why she said yes, why she's not unhappy that she said yes, is because she feels that if she's honest with herself, she would want the same thing. If she were in her friend's position, she too would not want to suffer and suffer and suffer. She too would want to have control over that moment, and she too would need help. And she even thinks at times, watching her friend, that her friend is even, you know, it's almost like a rehearsal, that her friend is showing her the way. Because it is true that to watch anyone die is to watch yourself die. You see your future there, and no one escapes this.
The thing I love so much about the detail of the relationship between the two women, and at one point, the narrator's talking about some of the humorous moments, and it is said that it's kind of like Lucy and Ethel do euthanasia. But that balance that you write about is so beautiful and so meaningful. Is that ever a challenge that you don't have it become Lucy and Ethel do euthanasia?
Well, at moments they kind of do resemble Lucy and Ethel. There's something about, you know, the best laid plans and so on. You know, this woman's idea that she can control all this at the end, and that she could even make it an aesthetic experience, and that there will be calm and order and things will go nicely, as it were. It's an illusion. That's not the way life works. And when you're dying, you're not dead. You're still living. Mm-hmm. And life is messy. There is a certain amount of comedy in the situation that was very easy for me to imagine. I mean, it was very easy for me to think of my friends, my women friends, and us in this kind of situation. And I know there would be comments such as are made and comic situations, because that's how my friends and I are. So I was really, you know, in a way thinking of people I knew and how they would behave in this situation. And that did include a certain amount of Lucy and Ethel behavior. I mean, I think of the times in my life, in fact, when somebody on the outside has referred to me and a friend of mine as Lucy and Ethel. Mm. Thelma and Louise has also come up. I mean, that's just something. Look out now, here come Thelma and Louise. I remember a man saying that as a friend of mine and I pulled up in a car. What have we done? All we were was in the car. We pull up and he says, I mean, so I guess it's just the way people sometimes see women who are, you know, friends or whatever. So anyway, that was on my mind, not to mention that I have always adored Lucille Ball, one of my great heroes.
Absolutely. There is a point as we wrap up that I want to get to, just because I was interested in this. You play with this notion every once in a while about the idea of looking for a word that doesn't exist, or hoping to learn another language where there is a word that exists for a particular feeling or a particular experience. I believe, and if I'm pronouncing this correct, the Bodo people, is that correct?
I believe so.
That you bring this up. Is given your language in the book and how beautiful and precise and how deeply you think about it, How often do you ponder that idea of finding that word and understanding it to the point that, yes, there must be something that is even better than what I have just put down?
The feeling that there is a better way to express what I'm expressing is, I think, the most, you know, one of the most common feelings that a writer has. This sense all the time that that you're struggling to find the right word. Why is it so hard to find the right word? But in particular, whenever you're trying to talk about the most important things, the strongest emotions, the strongest and most meaningful experiences that people have, why is it that that is when words fail you? And then you might discover that in another language they have a word for that, or they have an expression for that. But then you realize, but it's not, you know, there isn't one in English. But so that's always on my mind about the limits of language, and in particular how you grope for some way to say something that's meaningful at the most meaningful of times, and you come up with air. And then also the problem being that so much of the language of that would be meaningful that you would expect to be has been watered down, you know, from overuse or from misuse or whatever. So, and then, you know, people do fall back on these really thin statements, you know, that don't really help anyone and that no one wants to hear, such as, "I'm sorry for your loss."
Well, the book is so moving and comforting. It is What Are You Going Through, a novel that is published by Riverhead. Sigrid Nunez, thank you so much for being with us. What a great pleasure to have you back on the program.
Oh, again, thank you so much for having me back, Joe.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you. Again, the name of the new book is What Are You Going Through? It is published by Riverhead. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.